and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Timothy Leary, according to Richard Nixon, was the most dangerous man in America. Houston Smith wrote the book on world religions. Richard Alpert became Ram Dass. Andrew Weil turned the nation onto holistic health and natural foods. Four hugely influential men, but none acted alone, and in fact, their lives intersected as the 1960s began. The setting was a psychedelic drug research project at Harvard University. So what happened? What was the story of each man before the 60s began? And how did their engagement with psychedelic drug culture and with the decade's other countercultural and spiritual movements, how did their engagement continue or shift as the 60s turned into the 70s and beyond? Don Latin tells us a bevy of stories and offers plenty of his own insights in the book The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and ushered in a new age for America. When I sat down with Don in studio shortly after that book came out in 2011, I asked him whether the 60s and 70s would have unfolded in the same way if Leary, Smith, Ram Dass, and Weil had not been around.
Well, I think obviously a lot of the social changes that were happening in the 60s would still be happening. You know, there was the whole post-war economic boom, and there was a lot of freedom for people to experiment back then. And of course, there were all kinds of other things I don't get into in this book, the civil rights movement and all that were going on in the 60s, and the anti-war movement, you know, which Leary and Alpert were strangely kind of separate from. They were criticized for not being political enough. But I think that the changes that wouldn't have happened or wouldn't have happened to the same degree without them are the changes in the way people look at religion and spirituality, the way people look at the whole mind-body-spirit connection, holistic health, all that, yoga. I mean, you look at today, there's like yoga studios on every corner, organic produce because of the Andrew Weil connection. I mean, Safeway is selling organic produce. So I don't think it would have happened to the same degree. You know, other people were out there doing crazy things with LSD, like Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters on the West Coast. But Leary, in addition to being a brilliant man, was a shameless self-promoter. And he positioned himself as the Pied Piper of the psychedelic era, to the dismay of a lot of people. I mean, Warren Hinkle of Ramparts magazine back in the 60s called him the pretender to the hippie throne. But, you know, Leary was just such a force of nature. And, you know, on Nixon's enemies list, and, you know, Nixon called him the most dangerous man in America, to which Leary replied, oh, yeah, well, I have America surrounded. Which is a classic Tim Leary line. You know, I call him the trickster in the book. But he, I mean, Nixon was right. Leary was a dangerous man. I mean, he was really out there. He was saying everybody should turn on. He was turning his children on and you know, admitting it, his young children, to psychedelics. And in an interview he did in Playboy magazine in 66. He was really out there. And for Leary, it was an issue of cognitive freedom. It was a human rights issue that we have the right to alter our consciousness any way we see fit, as long as we're not harming anyone else in the process. So, you know, in the book, a lot of people say Leary came off looking pretty bad compared to the other characters, Andrew Weil, Houston Smith, and Ram Dass, Richard Alpert. But and he did in a way, because he was, like I said, a shameless self-promoter, and he really did set back the cause of serious psychedelic drug research about 30 years. So in a way, his main legacy is a negative one. The backlash, not just the backlash, the whole war on drugs, the war against street drugs, but the backlash against serious university scientific research, which is just coming back now in a really interesting way, which we can talk about if you want to.
Let's talk about Leary's early life. He, of all things, went to West Point for a while. A lot of people probably don't know that. There he was punished for certain misconduct by undergoing something called silencing. What is silencing, and what impact did that have on his worldview?
Yeah, Leary was kicked out of all kinds of institutions before he got kicked out of Harvard University. One of them was West Point, or he was almost kicked out of West Point. What it was the Army-Navy game. It was in the 1940s. Leary got just completely drunk, so drunk that he couldn't even stand up in revelry the next morning. Alcohol was really Timothy Leary's drug of choice. I mean, he was an alcoholic. I would call him an alcoholic. His whole life. But anyway, the silencing is basically you're shunned. I mean, no one talks to you. You're kind of a non-entity, and it's a way actually to get you to resign from West Point. But he just stuck through it. And he started seeing himself as an outsider and kind of a prophet. Some of it goes back to his experiences in the Air Force and just anti-authority. His whole thing was question authority. He started doing that early on, even before the Air Force, but that was the first time he really had a clash with a major institution. So, yeah, you can see that. An interesting thing is Richard Alpert, the man who would become Ram Dass, he also had an experience of shunning and silencing when some of his classmates at his boarding school and high school realized he was gay. And they had wanted nothing to do with him, and they shunned him. So they both had that experience of being outsiders at an early age, and I think that was important.
Leary got a master's in psychology from Washington State University, did his doctoral work at UC Berkeley from 1947 to 1950. What kind of name was Leary making for himself in the field of mainstream clinical psychology in the 50s?
Yeah, people forget that before he became infamous, Timothy Leary was a rising star in clinical psychology. He was an expert in personality assessment. That was his field. And he wrote a book, which was named the Book of the Year, and I think it was 58 or 59, by the American Psychological Association. Even before he took psychedelics, he was a radical in that he was questioning the power relationship between psychologist, clinical psychologist, and a research subject, or between therapist and patient. And when he started working with psychedelic drugs, what was controversial was not the fact that he was experimenting with psychedelic drugs. That was already going on for almost 10 years in the 1950s. What was radical about Leary is he was taking the drugs with the research subjects and talking about the shared experience they were having. That was the radical thing. Not that they were, I mean, all kinds of people were, I mean, he did these experiments at Concord Prison. And of course, people are notoriously giving prisoners, making prisoners guinea pigs in drug experiments. There was nothing new about that. But what was new about this is they were putting them in a loving, supportive environment with counseling and taking psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, with them and helping them look at their lives in a supportive, loving context. That's what was radical about Leary's approach.
Right. The researchers were taking psilocybin alongside the prisoners.
Yes, yes, with the prisoners. Yeah. And that was really looked down on, it, of course, at Harvard. And, you know, that was such a radical idea as a research model or as a therapeutic model.
Another guy profiled in the Harvard Psychedelic Club is Houston Smith. He was born in Suzhou, China in the year 1919. His parents were Methodist missionaries. What happened in Houston's childhood that had a lasting effect on the way he looked at the world?
Well, I think there were lots of experiences. Just the fact that he grew up in China and he was exposed to what we call popular Chinese religion, which is kind of a chop suey of all kinds of different spiritual traditions, Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, who knows, and a lot of animism, superstition, shamanism. So he saw that. They lived in a little village out in the middle of nowhere in China. I mean, his parents were, his father was trying to go where the gospel had not been preached. So he had some fascinating, you know, experiences just growing up there. And you may be referring to this. He was sent off to boarding school in Shanghai and had a hard time with it, the separation and the home loneliness and the homesickness, but also discovered this whole other world is out there. I mean, this kid grew up in this little village out in, you know, the boondocks in China, in the 20s and 30s, you know. So, and I think that gave him a glimpse that there's a larger world out there. And then, of course, a few years later, he comes here to a Bible college in the Midwest. And Houston lives about 10 blocks from where we are right now. He still lives in Berkeley. And, you know, he talks about, you know, his first trip to America when he was a teenager starting in Bible college and, you know, expected to become a Methodist missionary like his father. And this little podunk town, he said, but to him, it was like bright lights, big city. You know, I mean, he never said anything like it. All four of these guys had a fascinating life. And one of the challenges in the book is like what to leave out because there's just so much material. You know?
Well, one man who played a large role in Houston Smith's intellectual development was Aldous Huxley, of course, best known for his novel Brave New World. What was Huxley thinking and writing about that captured the imagination of Houston Smith when the two men finally met?
Houston met Huxley through another individual who's a very fascinating guy. It was Gerald Hurd who introduced Aldous Huxley to Houston Smith. Hurd and Huxley were old friends from when they were living in England. Hurd was a kind of a leading public intellectual between the two world wars. He was a philosopher. He was the first science correspondent on BBC radio. And he's really the man who got Huxley interested in philosophy and religion and spirituality. Huxley had originally been a pretty cynical kind of social satirist in his early novels. So the Huxley-Houston Smith connection began when Houston Smith became a fan of Gerald Hurd and sought out Gerald Hurd. Well, Houston actually first discovered Hurd when he was at Berkeley working on his PhD. And he read a book by Hurd called Pain, Sex, and Time. The title got his attention and was just blown away by Hurd's ideas and decided to read everything Hurd had written and then to find the man. So he did that. He found Hurd at this place called Trabuco College of Prayer, which was the kind of a proto-Esalen Institute. 20 years before Esalen Institute in the 1940s, it was a retreat center, interfaith study center in the Santa Ana Mountains in Southern California, where Hurd and Huxley had started the center. So Houston was teaching at Denver University. He hitchhiked all the way to Southern California for his meeting with Gerald Hurd. And then after he met with Hurd, Hurd said, "Would you like to meet my friend Aldous Huxley?" And so, yeah, of course, because Huxley had just written The Perennial Philosophy, which is really the book that I think influenced Houston. And The Perennial Philosophy is basically, it's about kind of the wisdom tradition that runs through all world religions, the common thread that runs through all world religions. And anyone who's familiar with Houston Smith's work can see that that's what he's been writing about for 50 years. So he was very influenced by Huxley's book and then had his meeting with Huxley.
That's the voice of Don Latin. He's a freelance journalist and author. We're talking about his book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Houston Smith went to Boston to teach Asian philosophy at MIT in 1958. By the time he invited Huxley to come to MIT to deliver a series of lectures, Huxley had published a book entitled The Doors of Perception. What was that book about?
The Doors of Perception is really, in a way, the book of Genesis of the psychedelic subculture, which would emerge later in the 1960s. This book, which was published in 1954, was about Huxley's first psychedelic drug experience, which was on mescaline in his home in the Hollywood Hills, and the mystical transcendent experiences that he had in his study, just looking at his curtains and in his study and being marveled by the, you know, by the wonders of existence, and, you know, looking at his corduroy trousers and just tripping out on that. Anyone who's taken LSD can relate to this feeling, this sort of ineffable, mystical, and maybe even silly, who knows, experiences and feelings that we can have on psychedelic drugs. Of course, later on, the Jim Morrison and the rock band The Doors took their name after The Doors of Perception. That's where they got the name. And it was a very influential book. And all of the four characters in my book, Harvard Psychedelic Club, they all read The Doors of Perception, and it had something to do with why they all came together.
And at that point, Houston Smith, while studying mystical experiences, still had not had a mystical experience to speak of. So he's speaking with Huxley, and what does he ask Huxley, and who does Huxley refer Houston to?
Well, yeah, Houston had been writing about mysticism and religion for many years. His most popular book, then called The Religions of Man, now called The World's Religions, had just been published in 1958. Houston had a nationwide TV show on, not PBS, the predecessor to PBS, National Educational Television, I think it was called, about the world's religions, exposing Americans to these exotic, other exotic faiths for the first time. Houston had invited Huxley to give a series of lectures to celebrate the centennial at MIT. And Huxley had heard about Timothy Leary, because this, what's amazing about this story is how all these people come together in the same time and place at Harvard University in Boston in the fall of 1960. And there's something in the air. I mean, Kennedy had just been elected president. Actually, the day Kennedy was elected president was the day that Aldous Huxley met Timothy Leary at a Boston restaurant. Leary wanted to bring in Aldous Huxley to what they were calling the Harvard Psilocybin Project as kind of a theological consultant. And Huxley, you know, he was too busy doing whatever he was doing, and he recommended Houston Smith. So it was really Huxley who got Leary and Houston together.
Leary had been vacationing in Mexico in the summer of 1960 when he first took magic mushrooms. What got Leary interested in mushrooms in the first place?
He actually didn't have that much interest in them. He had a friend named Frank Barron, who he knew back from the days in Berkeley when he was working on his PhD. And Frank Barron, who would go on to teach for many years later at UC Santa Cruz, had experiences on magic mushrooms and was telling Leary about them. And, you know, Leary wasn't all that interested. He was kind of surprised this guy was on such a soapbox about this thing. He didn't really understand it because he never had experienced it. So Leary was a 1 year into a 3 year appointment at Harvard. And he was on a summer vacation. He was down there with his two kids. He was a single father. His wife actually had committed suicide in Berkeley a few years earlier in the 1950s. That's all other story. So he's down on vacation with his kids and other professors and their wives and kids who were had a villa outside Acapulco. And Frank Barron suggested they go out and try to score some mushrooms, which they did. And so Leary had his first psychedelic drug experience around a swimming pool. It was kind of a pool party, a cocktail party, really, outside of Acapulco. He would later call that experience the most profound religious experience of his life. So he came back to his, in the fall, he came back to his classes at Harvard just absolutely on fire, convinced that LSD was not just going to change psychology, revolutionize psychology, it was going to change the world. And he started the Harvard Psilocybin Project, which later became the Harvard Psychedelic Project.
And Richard Alpert was his partner there, and Richard Alpert would become Ram Dass. What was the protocol that Alpert and Leary used at the Harvard Psilocybin Project? Who did they administer psilocybin to, and what were they looking for?
They were basically giving it to anyone who wanted it, which turned out to be the problem in the end and why they got in trouble. But basically, it was kind of just, you know, basic research. They were taking it and having their graduate students, mostly graduate students, take it and just write about their experiences. That's how it started, to try to understand the experiences that they were having. And what surprised them is they were having these religious experiences and spiritual experiences, mystical experiences. They didn't expect that. I mean, these were not religious or spiritual people. They were secular scientists. They were clinical psychologists, which is one reason they brought Houston in, to try to understand, were these, quote, authentic, close quote, religious experiences? Were these the same experiences that, you know, saints and sages and sadhus have been talking about for years? And so they brought Houston in as kind of a theological consultant to do that. Really, the only serious research projects that they did, Leary and Alpert did, was there were two. One was the Concord Prison Project, which I just mentioned earlier, where they were giving psilocybin to prisoners to see if they could reduce recidivism rates. And the other was called the Good Friday Experiment, where they were giving psilocybin in a double-blind experiment to a group of divinity students from Andover Newton Theological Seminary. And this happened in the basement of Marsh Chapel at Boston University on Good Friday. That's called the Good Friday Experiments. And then that was, Houston was very much involved with that project, as was another guy named Walter Pankey, who was really the main researcher. Leary was just kind of supervising it. And that was to get at this question of, are these authentic religious experiences?
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm CS. Joining me in studio is Don Lattin, L-A-T-T-I-N. He is the author of books like Jesus Freaks, A True Story of Murder and Madness on the Evangelical Edge, and Following Our Bliss, How the Spiritual Ideals of the 60s Shape Our Lives Today. We are talking about his best-selling book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club. It's about how Timothy Leary, Houston Smith, Ram Dass, and Andrew Weil intersected at Harvard in 1960-61, and how their engagement with psychedelics changed their lives and much of U.S. culture in the 60s and 70s. Before I ask you about Houston Smith's experience at the Good Friday Experiment, what did Leary and company, what results did they get from the Concord Prison Project as far as whether giving psilocybin to people in prison could reduce recidivism?
Leary claimed astoundingly successful results from that project. I can't recall the numbers exactly, and they were all over the chart anyway, but something like, you know, reduced recidivism rates by 75% or something like that. There were lots of problems with his research model. The main one being there was no control group. So they were giving a group of prisoners psilocybin. They were also counseling them. They were paying attention to them. They were talking about their lives. They were helping them. And when they got out of prison, they continued to counsel them, help them out in all kinds of different ways. So the problem with the research findings were, how do you know what part of their success was from the psilocybin and what part was from all the other support mm-hmm. they were getting? You had to have another group of prisoners who were getting all the same support and a placebo drug, which they did use in the Good Friday experiment. So you really can't take any of their findings seriously. And on top of that, someone went back years later, a guy named Rick Doblin, who's very much involved in psychedelic drug research today, went back and looked at a lot of the research modeling and found all kinds of problems with Leary's data. So what really happened with Leary and Alpert, they left science before science left them. I mean, they were on a crusade. And you know, that's fine, but they really weren't doing serious scientific research at all. As a matter of fact, they are the main reason that other serious scientists had to stop their research that was already going on for 10 years into the possible beneficial uses of psychedelic drugs.
At the Good Friday experiment, which took place in a chapel on the Boston University campus in 1962, Houston Smith was there, one of the participants. Some of them were given psilocybin, some of them were given a placebo. He got the drug. How profound an experience was that experiment that day in that chapel for Houston Smith?
Well, Houston would call it one of the most profound religious experiences of his life. It wasn't his first psychedelic drug experience. I mean, Leary had invited him to his house on New Year's Day, 1960-61, for Houston's first trip, which was profound in some ways and terrifying in other ways. Interesting to contrast that with the Good Friday experiment, because this research, the seminary students and the Houston was one of the guides, but the guides were also getting the drug or a placebo. They didn't even know what they were getting. It was completely blind, you know, double blind test. So they were in the basement of Marsh Chapel while the Good Friday service is going on. I mean, Howard Thurman, the black civil rights leader, was actually delivering the sermon upstairs in Marsh Chapel. They had like an audio feed down in the stairs in this little chapel. I went to this place when I'm doing my research. It's like a tomb. It's a very creepy room. I would not want to take psychedelic drugs in it. But Houston had a very profound experience, I think, because it was in the context of a Christian worship service. He was an ordained Methodist minister. He was a Christian. And so he was familiar with the hymns and the prayers in this service and saw them in this just deeper experiential way. So it makes a lot of sense that he would have such a profound experience in a Christian context.
When and why did LSD replace psilocybin as Leary's research drug of choice?
Well, Leary was scared to take LSD. He was frightened by it. And, you know, a lot of people will say Leary was kicked out of Harvard for taking LSD. Not true. It was psilocybin, you know, which is a similar drug, but not as nearly as powerful as LSD can be, especially in larger doses. And, at a certain point, other researchers were using LSD. It was out there. And at a certain point, they started, it was really around the time they left Harvard. In 1962, 63, when they really started shifting over and using LSD. It's such a powerful experience and also can be a dangerous experience psychologically. They were starting to get kind of fast and loose with their so-called research protocol. I mean, at a certain point, you have to stop calling it a research project and start calling it either a drug cult, the beginnings of a social movement, a big party. Choose your title. But it really was not a research project anymore. And LSD is such a powerful drug, that's when things really started snowballing.
Don Lattin has taught at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He's a freelance journalist, and his book is The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America, published by Harper One. It's out in paperback. I'm CS. We'll take a short music break and be back with Don Lattin. Please stay with us.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song, and Don Latin joins us in our KPFA Berkeley studios. He is a journalist. He's the author of a number of very interesting books about spirituality and evangelism, and his latest book is The Harvard Psychedelic Club, about Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil, and how they all intersected at Harvard in the early 1960s, but it also covers what happens to each one of them, and it's based on a lot of research and a lot of interviews with these four men, as well as a number of other people. Well, you've referred a number of times to the fact that Leary got kicked out of Harvard, and it really was an investigation and an article written in the campus newspaper, The Harvard Crimson, that eventually brought down both Leary and Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass, and got them kicked out of Harvard. That investigation was spurred by a Crimson reporter named Andrew Weil. What happened?
Andrew Weil was an undergraduate at Harvard. In the fall of 1960, he was in his first year at Harvard. He actually started as a sophomore. Tells you how brilliant Andrew Weil was and is. Mm. He had read The Doors of Perception, Huxley's book, and he'd heard about this Harvard psilocybin project. He wanted to be a research subject. So he went to both Leary and Alpert and volunteered, but they had agreed to only use graduate students. The university actually demanded that they only use graduate students because these, like I said, these drugs can be dangerous, at least psychologically dangerous. Actually, Weil went off and did his own little kind of undergraduate version of the grown-ups research project at his dorm in Harvard with some friends. They actually forged letters on stationery to chemical companies and got a supply of mescaline and did their own little experiment. But later on, one of the other undergraduates who was working with Weil, the dorm mate of Weil, this guy named Ronnie Winston, ran into Professor Alpert, the man who would become Ram Dass, at a party, and they became friends. And Ram Dass actually admits that he had a kind of romantic attraction to Ronnie Winston. At the time, Alpert was a gay man living in the closet, as most people were in 1960, and developed this very intimate friendship with Ronnie Winston and led him in, as a guide on some psilocybin sessions. And Weil heard about that and heard other undergraduates were being let in and basically got jealous. Why wasn't I? Why can't I be part of the party or the research? And decided to do an expose on the Harvard Crimson. And it's the way he went about it that is shocking to me as a journalist. I mean, he wasn't just working as an investigative reporter. He was also working as a spy for the Harvard administration, turning over his notes in interviews with the people he was interviewing for this expose, trying to get evidence that Alpert was giving drugs to undergraduates in violation of the agreement they had with the university. But none of the undergraduates wanted to admit that because they either were having a good time or thought it was important research or for whatever reason. So Weil went to Ronnie Winston's father, who was Harry Winston. And some of your listeners may have heard of Harry Winston, the diamond jewelry designer family, very well-known East Coast family. So Weil goes to Ronnie's father, Ronnie Winston's father, and says, your son is taking psychedelic drugs or dangerous drugs with a, I don't know if he said homosexual professor or not, but a professor at Harvard. And if he doesn't admit it to the university, we're going to put his name in the paper as part of this drug scandal. Well, Harry Winston did not want his family's name in his drug expose at Harvard. So it pressured his son, Ronnie, to go admit to the university that he got drugs from Professor Alpert. And he was so Ronnie Winston is called into Nathan Pusey, the president of Harvard at the time, and called into his office and asked, did Professor Alpert give you drugs? And Ronnie paused and said, yes, sir, he did, and it was the most educational experience I've had at Harvard. And they didn't care about that. I mean, that was the evidence that they needed to fire Richard Alpert, who was a tenure-track professor. It's not easy to get rid of these guys. The deal that Weil had with Harvard, with the administration, was the day before you actually fire him, you'll let us know, and we'll have the story first. So they had that story on the front page of the Crimson. The next day, it was on the front page of the New York Times, a Harvard drug scandal. And Leary and Alpert were kicked out of Harvard and propelled onto the national stage as the, you know, the leading proponents of this whole psychedelic revolution, which was about to sweep across the country in the 1960s. And it was Andrew Weil who pushed them off onto that stage.
The news story in the Crimson was accompanied by an editorial co-written by Weil. Let me read a passage of that editorial. Leary and Alpert fancy themselves prophets of a psychic revolution designed to free Western man from the limitations of consciousness as we know it. They are contemptuous of all organized systems of action, of what they call the roles and games of society. They prefer mystical ecstasy to the fulfillment available through work, politics, religion, and creative art. Yet, like true revolutionaries, they will play these games to further their own ends. In your opinion, is this pretty accurate?
That's actually a great question. And yes, it actually was pretty accurate. They were always talking about games. That was their whole thing. Game theory was Leary's cry at the time. And yeah, in a way it was. I mean, like I said before, I mean, they left science. Science didn't leave them. Although, on the other hand, they were actually still being fairly cautious at Harvard for the most part. I mean, the wild days hadn't really begun. Those really started when they got kicked out. You know, they had medical supervision, a lot of these experiments they were doing. They really prepared people. I mean, that's really the advance that Leary and Alpert made, is the whole importance of set and setting. When you take psychedelic drugs, you have to be in a very secure, safe setting and understand what you're doing and have a guide and be very careful. So they were, in a way, they were much more cautious than, for instance, compared to what Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters were doing out on the West Coast with dosing thousands of people at parties. Many people didn't even know they were getting LSD. But yeah, I mean, in a way, Weil's critique was right on the money, although he didn't say that he had been doing his own research. And then later on, a few years after that, Weil wrote a big article in Look magazine, big national magazine, about the inside story of the Harvard drug scandal, where he basically outed Alpert. I mean, by innuendo, he talked about there were all kinds of affairs, heterosexual and homosexual, going on. This is in Look magazine. So this is why there are a lot of hard feelings to this day between, from Ram Dass's point of view, about Andrew Weil.
So after Timothy Leary is expelled from Harvard, he goes to Mexico, and their research focus turns to LSD, and then he's kicked out of Mexico and then out of Antigua and Dominica, and you can read about all this stuff in the Harvard Psychedelic Club. So many great stories in this book. He ends up in an upstate New York estate owned by an heir to the Mellon banking and oil fortune, a guy named Hitchcock. What were Leary and Alpert studying on this estate called Millbrook in terms of LSD's impact on the human mind and human behavior?
Well, I mean, a lot of what they were doing at Millbrook, which was the estate, was a big party. But they were also, I mean, they were trying to understand how these drugs worked and how they could be used to program or imprint behavior, in their case, like positive behavior in people's lives. I mean, it's interesting to note that at the same time and earlier on, the CIA and the Army were doing their own experiments about whether you could imprint behavior on prisoners with psychedelic drugs, whether you could use these drugs as a truth serum or spray them on enemy troops as weapons of mass distraction, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than destruction. Everyone knew that LSD was an incredibly powerful drug, but they couldn't figure out what to do with it. Everybody wanted to do something with it, including Sandoz Laboratories, who were trying to sell it, you know, the manufacturer of it. So they were just trying to see if you could really change yourself permanently with psychedelic drugs. And I mean, one of the experiments they did at Millbrook is Richard Alpert and about a half dozen other people locked themselves in this building on the outskirts of the estate, the Millbrook Estate. Actually, it was an old bowling alley that they had. And they lived together for 2 weeks. They took LSD, a large dose of LSD, every 4 hours. For 2 weeks to see what would happen.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. Anyone who's taken LSD can sort of, you know, they're falling off their chair. And the funny thing is they found out two things. One, you can only get so high. At a certain point, you just don't get any higher. And at the end of the 2 weeks, they all wanted to kill each other. So it didn't bode well for using this drug to, you know, foster, you know, mutual understanding and harmony and all that. And it was really the beginning of Alpert seeing the end of kind of the psychedelic drug era, and then going on off to India and finding a teacher and really recommending kind of kinder, softer, gentler ways to approach these states than through drugs, but through meditation and other spiritual practices.
Who were some of the 60s luminaries who hung out with Timothy Leary and Alpert at Millbrook and also at their house in Boston before, in Newton, Mass, before they were ejected from Harvard?
Yeah, that's the wonderful thing about this story. There are cameo appearances by all kinds of people. I mean, Allen Ginsberg, who was already well known as, you know, the most infamous beat poet in the country. His poem Howl had been published and won a big censorship trial just a few years before this in the 1950s. And actually, Leary brought Ginsberg in to try to use his notoriety to sort of get respect in kind of the counterculture, what was the beginning of the counterculture circles then. So for a while, he had in his house outside of Harvard, he had Allen Ginsberg staying there. He had William Burroughs, the novelist and junkie, up in the attic doing whatever William Burroughs would do up in the attic, you know. And Ginsberg's boyfriend, Orlovsky, and other people were passing through. I mean, Maynard Ferguson, a jazz musician, was around. Alan Watts, Buddhist scholar, he comes in. Of course, Huxley had been there earlier. All kinds of folks. And on the other side, you had people like G. Gordon Liddy, who was the local county district attorney in the county of New York where Millbrook was. He was making a name for himself by being the guy who busted Timothy Leary. So
He raided Millbrook, yeah.
And got Leary, one of the several times Leary was arrested. It was G. Gordon Liddy. And made a name for himself, actually, with the FBI. The reason he called himself G. Gordon Liddy was after his hero, J. Edgar Hoover. That's why he used the first initial.
Yeah.
And that's how he originally made a name for himself. It was one of the great sort of postscripts is years later, Leary and Liddy become friends and go out on the lecture circuit. You know, kind of two washed up guys trying to sell some books. They were both showmen, you know. So it's just amazing the people who pass through this
period. It really is. And after Millbrook, then Leary ends up in San Francisco in the Bay Area, part of the Summer of Love. He's witness to all of Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters' activities and all, you know, the human being. Houston Smith in 1966 arrives in the Bay Area to deliver an academic paper. What did he think of the psychedelic scene unfolding in San Francisco? And at that point, what relationship did he have to Leary and Leary's ideas and vision?
Well, by 1966, Houston had already pretty much separated himself from the Leary and Alpert gang. I mean, he was very, very central the first year or two. But he saw, as many people did, a troubling megalomania in Timothy Leary, which was definitely there, and was also a little shocked by how wild the party had begun, a lot of the sexual acting out. And the just, you know, people, a lot of people, face it, were just taking drugs to get high. I mean, it was a big party, a lot of it. And Houston wasn't interested in that. I mean, he was an ordained Methodist minister. He was happily married. It just wasn't his scene. And he also was asking himself, well, are these really authentic religious experiences that we are having on these drugs? And his conclusion was, and I agree with this, having gone through this myself, is that, yeah, the experience you have on psychedelic drugs is pretty much the same thing, mystical experience, as someone can have maybe through meditation or other spiritual practices. The brain chemistry might be the same in some ways, but what's important is not the experience, is what you do with the experience. I mean, does it make you a better person, a more aware and compassionate person? Does it give you some kind of a motivation for work towards social justice, as legitimate religious movements should do in Houston's mind? You know, he didn't see a real religion developing in that way. So he came out here in 66. Actually, that was the point of the paper he delivered at this LSD conference. And Houston also was kind of shocked at the scene out here. And so was when Leary and Alpert first came out. They were shocked, too. I mean, these guys were still pretty buttoned down. They were still coats and ties.
Mm-hmm.
And they really had no idea how wild things were. It was just starting. It was really like 65 when they came out. In the Hate, you know, the whole beginning of the hippie counterculture, the BN and all of that, and Kesey. I mean, they heard about Kesey, but they just didn't realize. You know, they went to the psychedelic bookstore in the Hate, and they went to these parties that just blew them away. So it was really interesting because you had these two different sort of psychedelic scenes going on at Harvard and then around the Bay Area.
His name is Don Lattin. He's the author of The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. We've got a link on againstthegrain.org to Don's website, as well as to his book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club. His other books include Jesus Freaks, Following Our Bliss, and he's also co-author of Shopping for Faith, American Religion in the New Millennium. Leary told at least one reporter, I think it was in San Francisco, something about the intellectual elite leading the way in the psychedelic revolution. What was his message there?
Well, actually, it was Aldous Huxley and others who really thought the intellectual elite should lead the way with LSD. And they didn't think, like, Huxley didn't think, like, every man was ready for LSD, that it was an important, that it could really be used as a force for social change, but you had to turn on the opinion makers and the elite and have it kind of trickle down, trickle down enlightenment or something. Whereas Leary was really for every man turning. I mean, he thought it was a matter of cognitive freedom. Everyone had the right to alter their consciousness. And that was really the dispute. And same with Houston Smith, that, you know, they saw these drugs weren't for everyone, and they're not for everyone. They can be very dangerous psychologically, even if you're getting the real thing, which, of course, you know, one thing I like to stress in interviews is, you know, you got to be really careful with these drugs, especially if you buy them on the street. You don't know what you're getting, and they're illegal. And people forget that these drugs were legal. LSD was legal till 1966, you know, and it wasn't seen in the same way as it is now.
You have at least one person in your book describing how Houston has influenced interfaith and religious studies programs and activities all the way to the present day. What insights did Smith contribute to these disciplines and movements?
Well, Houston was a very open-minded scholar, and he would go into what's interesting about the way he studied different world religions is he wasn't interested in analyzing the dogma and the doctrine and or the theology so much. He was interested in that, but he wanted to understand the core, the mystical core of every religion. And when he would do his research, nothing to do here with psychedelics, but when he would do his research, I mean, he would try to seek out like the Zen masters or the Sufi mystics or the Christian monks and to try to understand the religion from the inside out and to practice the religion. I mean, he was a practicing Christian his whole life, still is. But he was very involved with a Vedanta movement, which is kind of a Hindu movement, a missionary movement in this country, meditating, you know, began meditating in the 1940s. He went to Japan and studied with a Zen master. He went all over the world really trying to understand the common kind of mystical truth that runs through all these religions. And, of course, when you take psychedelic drugs, that's what you sort of experience in a way. It's the experience of religion that hits you, and it does kind of transcend denominational boundaries in many ways.
You write that Leary, Timothy Leary, was largely to blame for the crackdown on responsible psychedelic drug research in the U.S. Some would also say that the backlash against the counterculture in the New Left, the conservative resurgence in the 1980s, the war on drugs, all that can also be laid at Leary's door. What do you think of those kinds of assertions?
I think that's going a little overboard, actually. There was so much else going on in the 60s. I mean, just within the psychedelic drug world, you had, of course, the Ken Kesey and the Murray Pranksters and all of that happening out here on the West Coast. I think it's true. I mean, in the broader war on drugs, Leary, I think, had a lot to do with. But, you know, Leary was a clinical psychologist. He was at Harvard. I mean, he was in the academy. He was a university researcher. So he really left a bad taste in the mouths of many people about what the possibilities are for these drugs. I mean, people forget there was all kinds of fascinating research in the 1950s about using LSD for all kinds of things, treat alcoholism and depression and various things like that. And it was all kind of shut down, I think largely because of Professor Leary. I just wrote a magazine piece about this whole new wave of psychedelic drug research that's happening right now. And you talk to some of these people were still doing it back in those days. I mean, you know, they've been around that long. And, you know, they talk about the lull in the research, the 30 to 40 year lull.
Yeah.
And so right now you've got, for instance, you've got the FDA and the DEA, the federal government signing off on a pilot study that's going on right now using MDMA, which is ecstasy, which a lot of people took in the whole rave scene in the 90s and maybe now. Using ecstasy to treat returning Iraqi and Afghan war veterans suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And there's been some promising results. And it's a huge problem because no one knows what to do with all these guys that are coming back from the wars. And so that's just one example. There's all kinds of interesting research going on right now, and it's taken that long for us to recover from Timothy Leary.
You quote one observer saying that what Leary did more than anything else was activate conservative anxiety in America. True?
He did. I mean, he was a brilliant guy. He was articulate. He was funny. He knew how to manipulate the media. He actually had private lessons from Marshall McLuhan about how to manipulate the media. So, yeah, I mean, he was a trickster. I mean, that's what I call him in the book. I have a healer, teacher, trickster, seeker, the four characters. And Leary is the trickster.
The trickster is, I think you use the term in the context of a Native American.
A trickster would be someone, mostly from Native American lore, someone like the whole Carlos Castaneda, you know, Don Juan kind of model, someone who kind of tricks you into a new way of thinking. Sort of through irrational kind of action or games or tricks. And Leary was definitely a trickster. I mean, some people say Leary was a brilliant prophet, a crusader for cognitive freedom, and helped, foster the cause of enlightenment. Others, you know, say he was a shameless self-promoter and a con artist and a publicity whore and a megalomaniac. And someone asked Leary, well, what are you? And his reply was, "You get the Timothy Leary you deserve." You know, so that's kind of a trickster kind of way, throwing it back on you. You know,
right.
and taking no responsibility for his actions.
is the story in your book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, is it largely about four men moving from the rational to the intuitive, from the linear to the mystical to the spiritual? Is that really what this story is about? And if so, then might it not interest people who are, you know, very sort of mainstream, linear, rational kinds of thinkers?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it's a group biography of these four guys, but they all went through this transformation after taking psychedelic drugs, which happened to millions of other people in this country. I mean, I covered the religion beat at the San Francisco Chronicle for 2 decades, and I did a lot of stories on, you know, Buddhism in the West. And you interview people who are serious students of Buddhism, and a lot of times they'll say, oh, yeah, it all started with this acid trip back in 1966, you know. I think there's not really appreciation of the positive benefit that these drugs have had. And I really see it in two or three areas. The one is the whole way we look at religion and spirituality. I mean, so many people today say, oh, I'm into spirituality, not religion. And, you know, what do they mean by that? Well, I think what they're talking about largely is that they're into the experience of religion, the core experience of religion, spiritual experience, the whole thing about the 60s. Are you experienced? You know, Jimi Hendrix and all of that. And, of course, there are a lot of reasons for that, not just psychedelic drugs, but I've seen numbers like 23 million people took psychedelics in the 60s and 70s. That's a huge number of people.
And, it sure is.
And it's a very profound experience for people. And even if they just did it once or twice, you know, most people you talk to, they'll say, well, it was the most amazing thing I'd ever experienced in my life. So obviously that has to have a huge effect. And then in the lives of these individuals, I mean, Houston Smith, you know, he took it in terms of influencing the way people look at religion, having more tolerance for other faiths by understanding this common mystical core through all major religions. And then Andrew Weil, while he's kind of the villain in the early pages of my book, he does redeem himself in the end. And he tried to apologize for years for what he did to Leary and Alpert. He's ashamed of it. He talked about it. I interviewed him about it. He admits it. You know, he's not proud of it. But, you know, he went on to be a leader in holistic health and in one of the leading spokesmen for the reformation of the American healthcare system and the real reformation of the healthcare system about how we look at preventative medicine and all of that, organic food and holistic health. And so you look at that and how popular just organic produce is, for instance. Or, you know, with Ram Dass. I mean, Ram Dass came back as one of the most important spiritual teachers of my generation. By that, I mean the baby boom generation. You know, his book Be Here Now was very influential and inspired a lot of people to get into meditation and yoga. And, you know, you look at, there's the yoga studios on every corner today. Mm-hmm. So I think, and also just the whole, you know, it's not so much any particular vision, it's the whole process of envisioning. When you have such a profound experience, such as a reality-shattering experience as you can have on psychedelics, it opens you up to new ways of looking at things. And I think that opening up was what really happened. There's a lot of specific effects you can see and social movements and trends you can see, but just the whole process of envisioning, of opening yourself up was key.
Don Lattin, Lattin, on againstthegrain.org, we have a link to his website as well as to his book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club. Don, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. That was great.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. You can also check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. That's Against the Grain Radio on Facebook.